This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Elsa Partan in for Heather Goldstone. Today, a total solar eclipse will pass over the homes of 12 million people. It's got a 3,000-mile path that starts in Oregon and ends in South Carolina, looking like a narrow seatbelt across the continental United States. It's been 99 years since an eclipse has crossed coast to coast. This one will likely be one of the most viewed eclipses of all time. In just a minute, we'll talk to NASA about citizen science that you can do here in Massachusetts, where we will see a partial eclipse. But first, let's go to Regina Jorgensen of Nantucket's Mariah Mitchell Association. She has traveled to Oregon to be in the path of the total eclipse, and she joins me now by phone. Hello, Regina.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad you could join us early in the morning. It's only 6 o'clock in the morning where you are. Where exactly are you?
Yeah, that's right. I'm actually in Redmond, Oregon, which is north of Bend, and Redmond is just inside the path of totality.
And where will you be to watch the eclipse today, do you think?
So I'm playing it by ear a little bit. Original plan was to go up to north of here a little bit to a town called Madras. But I was going to see how the traffic was going to be and how crazy it was looking, and then sort of make a decision, because even if I stay where I am, I'll still be in the path, which is good.
And traffic, people were a bit worried about traffic because, 70 miles wide is not that wide for a lot of people to join the roads in that area. What's the report so far?
That's right. We were driving, doing a little bit of a test drive yesterday, and it was heavy but not horrible yesterday. So I think a lot of people were driving early in the previous couple of days up into the site. And I heard getting into the couple sites at Madras where they're having events was about a 3 to 4 hour wait. But this morning it's looking heavy again, but not horrible.
Get it.
So I think it's a little bit better than people were predicting.
And what's your mood? Have you seen a total solar eclipse before?
I have not, so I'm super excited. I've seen a couple partial eclipses, which are still great and really, really neat to see, but I've never seen totality before, so I could not be more excited.
And what about the mood of the area? Have you seen celebrations starting up yet?
Oh, yes, yes. It's been lots of fun. You see cars that are all painted with signs, eclipse or bust, or, sort of people have decorated their cars, the signs in front of stores and grocery stations, grocery stores and gas stations say all sorts of fun things. I saw one yesterday that said, welcome to our 300,000 closest friends, so people are definitely getting into it here and excited about the eclipse.
Now, the weather looks pretty clear, except you've got some smoke in the air. Is that right?
That's right. Unfortunately, there's several large forest fires in the area, and so smoke has been a concern. I know they've shut down certain state park areas that a lot of people were planning to go to because of the fire danger. So that's a little bit of a bummer. But it looks like most of where I am, at least, most of the smoke is more on the horizon. And so I'm thinking that it won't be a problem for actually observing the eclipse.
Let's talk about what's happening back on Nantucket today.
Right. So Nantucket, unfortunately, I won't be there, but we've got several people there who are going to be running our solar eclipse party, and that'll happen on the campus of Mariah Mitchell Observatory on Vestal Street, so at 3 Vestal Street. And it'll happen from about 1:30 to 4 p.m., we're going to shut down the street. We'll have our solar telescope, our sunspotter, and various sort of projection capabilities, pinhole cameras and whatnot for people to use. And then we'll also have, we have about 200 solar viewing glasses that we'll have there available for people to use while they're at the party. Mm. And so we're just trying to make, sort of give as much possibility for people to safely observe the eclipse.
Mm. We should also say there are eclipse events at the Salt Pond Visitor Center in Eastham, Cape Cod Museum of Natural History in Brewster, Heritage Museums and Gardens in Sandwich, the UMass Dartmouth Observatory, and many, many public libraries throughout the region. Chances are your public library is doing something, but they may not have eclipse glasses for you. Just a warning, I've heard a lot of places have run out. So if you've got glasses, bring them with you. Don't forget them. And there, of course, are other ways that we'll be talking about in the hour of watching the eclipse if you don't have the eclipse glasses. Well, that is Regina Jorgensen of the Mariah Mitchell Association. Have a great time today.
Thank you. You too.
She is in Eastern Oregon right now to view the total solar eclipse later today. And I'm Elsa Partan. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Heather Goldstone. Here in Massachusetts, we will not see a total solar eclipse, but that doesn't mean we can't get involved. NASA has a program called Globe Observer, which collects data from citizen scientists. And as it turns out, they want to know about conditions during the partial eclipse, too. Kristen Weaver is with NASA's Globe Observer program and joins me now. Welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hello.
What kind of information will you be collecting during the solar eclipse today?
We are interested in data about clouds, cloud cover and cloud type, as well as air temperature. Those are the primary types of data we'll be collecting during the eclipse.
Okay, so how do people contribute to this data collection?
So if you download the Globe Observer app, it's free and available in the Google Play Store and on the Apple Store. Quick free registration, and then the app will actually walk you through how to make cloud observations. So even if you don't know the names of cloud types or anything like that, it'll walk you through the steps. And then special for the eclipse, if you get a separate thermometer, anything from a simple liquid-filled thermometer to a digital patio-type thermometer, then we'll have special data collection to have you enter every few minutes the air temperature as it changes.
And so just any old thermometer and then your own eyes, you need to take a picture of the cloud, or how do you know that what people are going to be describing?
Well, so it'll walk you through. First, we ask for like general cloud cover, what percentage of the sky is covered by clouds. And then actually at each level of clouds, it'll divide it out. So it'll show you a picture of a cirrus cloud so you can look and see if you see that. And then at the end, we do actually also ask for pictures, which can be a verification later on if we want to go back and look at your observations and just kind of match up. Does the pictures match what you reported in the form? So it's a little bit of both.
And what will you do with the data once you get all of this input from all across the country?
So the data is going to go into the database of the GLOBE program, which is a school-based citizen science project that's been around for over 20 years. So that database is accessible to anyone. So students, we hope, will use this data for some of their own projects. But we also have some scientists here at NASA Goddard who are potentially interested in looking at the data and looking at these atmospheric changes. And then, of course, it's also open to the citizen scientists themselves. If they want to see what was happening in other parts of the country during the eclipse, it's also available for them to look at and see their own patterns.
What kind of scientific questions might be asked with this data, asked or partially answered with this data?
So we know that the sun the Earth is a very solar-powered planet. So having the sun blocked for this period of time, we expect to make changes in the atmosphere. I've seen some suggestions that maybe it will actually decrease cloud cover because of the cooler temperatures, but also some anecdotal reports that actually that lower temperature can increase clouds. So I think just knowing what will happen when the sun is blocked with the clouds, I'm not sure we totally understand all that. Also, some of the data can go into modeling to help understand Earth's energy budget, because all of these systems are so interconnected that if you take out the sun for a short time, that affects evaporation and cloud formation, precipitation. Maybe we'll see a difference in storms, whether as many storms will develop on that day since the sun is blocked for a period of time. So there's actually really a lot of different questions related to the Earth's energy budget and how the Earth's systems interact that we may be able to answer with this data.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kristen Weaver of NASA's Globe Observer program about citizen science and things you can do today during the partial solar eclipse here in Massachusetts. So here, the partial eclipse will take about 2.5 hours. It starts around 1:30 in the afternoon and ends around 4, and the peak is about 2:45 in the afternoon. What time span should people be collecting the temperature and the cloud cover? Are they supposed to do it for the entire time, or do you need to start now, or how long, how many hours should we dedicate to this?
Well, that depends on what you're willing to do. We'd actually really love people to start even before the eclipse begins, so even about 2 hours before the maximum, to start collecting data so we have a baseline before the eclipse starts affecting things. And then after the maximum eclipse, continuing for about 2 hours. But of course, you know, we'll take any data that people are willing to go out and collect for us. So if it's a half an hour around the maximum, that's good too. You know, we're asking people to do this on a voluntary basis. So whatever data for whatever time frame, we're happy to have.
So let's talk safety. It doesn't matter whether it's a total eclipse or a partial eclipse. It's dangerous to look at the sun without risking permanent damage to your eyes. So hopefully you already have some solar eclipse glasses. But if you don't, is there anything you can do today?
Absolutely. There are lots of ways you can observe the eclipse without having the eclipse glasses. Of course, we're asking you to look at clouds and temperature, which doesn't require looking at the sun at all. But if you want to observe the progress of the eclipse, there's some opportunities to make your own pinhole camera and all sorts of other things. Even you can actually just kind of cross your fingers in a lattice and look at the sun with the sun over your shoulder, and you will actually be able to see the partial eclipse, the shape of the partial eclipse coming across the sun, even with something as simple as that. You can find all sorts of details on eclipse2017.nasa.gov, lots of ways to look at the eclipse without needing solar glasses.
If people enjoy doing this data collection, are there other projects like this that they can do with NASA?
Well, actually, the Globe Observer program is ongoing, so we have this special air temperature just for the eclipse, but we always have clouds in our app, and we love to have clouds observations from people all over anytime they want to make those observations. We also have a mosquito habitat mapper looking at places where mosquitoes might be breeding, and even a little bit about the types of larvae you might find. So you can continue with Globe Observer after the eclipse for as long as people want to keep sending us clouds data and mosquito data.
Kristen Weaver is with NASA's Globe Observer program, which will be collecting data from citizen scientists across the country today, maybe from you. A link at our website, capeandislands.org. Kristen Weaver, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we talk with the person who holds the record for seeing the most solar eclipses anywhere in the world. This is Living Lab Radio. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Heather Goldstone. It's Solar Eclipse Day across the United States, and we're talking to astronomers near and far. Now we turn to Jay Pasikoff, the Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy at Williams College and a committed eclipse chaser. He has seen 65 eclipses. 33 of them were total eclipses. That makes him the record holder in the world for seeing eclipses. Jay Pasikoff, welcome to Living Lab.
I'm very glad to be with you, Elsa.
Where are some of the most distant places you've traveled to watch a solar eclipse?
Well, I'll tell you where the most exotic place I've been, and that's Oregon, because of the 33 total eclipses I've seen, I've never seen one from the continental United States. Maybe to be a little more serious, I overflew Antarctica. We've seen a couple of things from Cape Town, and once in a plane, an hour's flight south of Cape Town. We were just in Patagonia in Argentina. Papua New Guinea was one of the most exotic places that I've been in from the point of view of an American traveler. Siberia in 2008. Svalbard at latitude 78 in the Arctic in 2015. So these eclipses come all over the world, and it just happens that this time it's our turn in the United States.
And so where in Oregon will you watch the eclipse later today?
Well, I have a big scientific organization with me. I'm very fortunate to have a grant from the U.S. National Science Foundation for the main research and also a grant for some of the research from the National Geographic Society. So we need facilities. And therefore, I needed not just a place by the side of the road, but a real base. And when I discovered that in the most favorable region in the cloudiness statistics, there was a city, Salem, Oregon. And then I looked up what was there, and Willamette University is there. And eventually I discovered that the president of Willamette University is actually an astronomer. Then we've settled there, and we're getting very good facilities, very good hospitality.
And what are some of the things that you will be doing during the eclipse?
I felt an obligation with this American eclipse to do everything I could conceive of at an eclipse. So we have a wide variety, and of course I have a dozen professional colleagues with me and eight of our Williams College undergraduates. And we have a bunch of alumni and 50 Japanese astronomers and 28 Chinese astronomers all associated with us. So in any case, I have a variety of telescopes with cameras ranging from regular Nikons, although the fanciest, newest ones, to some CCD, so-called charge-coupled devices, the electronic cameras. We have a very elaborate set of very fast readout special cameras that we call POETS, which stands for Portable Occultation Eclipse and Transit System. So in other words, I've got a whole kitchen sink of scientific apparatus ready to observe and record the data on this eclipse.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jay Pasikoff, astronomer at Williams College and the record holder for the person who has seen the most solar eclipses. I want to read this passage from writer Annie Dillard in which she describes watching a total solar eclipse on a rural hillside in central Washington on February 26, 1979. She writes, "From all the hills came screams. A piece of sky beside the crescent sun was detaching. It was a loosened circle of evening sky, suddenly lighted from the back. It was an abrupt black body out of nowhere. It was a flat disk. It was almost over the sun. That is when there were screams. At once this disk of sky slid over the sun like a lid. The sky snapped over the sun like a lens cover. The hatch in the brain slammed. The hatch in the brain slammed. Abruptly it was dark night on the land and in the sky. In the night sky was a tiny ring of light. The hole where the sun belongs is very small. A thin ring of light marked its place. There was no sound. The eyes dried, the arteries drained, the lungs hushed. There was no world. We were the world's dead people, rotating and orbiting around and around, embedded in the planet's crust, while the earth rolled down." What's your reaction to this description?
I think it's spot on. I think it takes a talented writer like Annie Dillard to describe what's going on, because people keep asking me what it's like and why is it worth the trouble, and I try to explain. Sometimes people who have been with me on an eclipse come over afterward and say, "Jay, you tried to explain how wonderful it was, and it was even better than that." I was very pleased when I heard from Ms. Dillard about where she might go, so I sent her some advice, though I didn't hear back, so I don't know exactly where she is for the eclipse. But I hope we get another lyrical description the way we got of that last one.
Let's talk about more the science of eclipses. You chair the International Astronomical Union's Working Group on Solar Eclipses. Solar telescopes can look at the sun all the time. What can we still learn from solar eclipses?
Well, you have to define what looking at the sun is. So the sun has various parts. There's a core, so the solar telescope can't look at that. We have ways of finding out what's going on in the core. There's what we call a surface, what we call photosphere, because photos is the Greek word for light, so it's the sphere from which the light comes, and that's what we see every day. I just sometimes call it the everyday sun. And then around that are a couple of normally invisible layers. So and one is the chromosphere, which is colorful, just a very thin layer, just right above the photosphere. But around that is the corona, and we really can't study that whole corona in any other way in the whole lower and middle corona than at an eclipse. There are some artificial eclipses you can try to make. Even the best from the highest mountains on Earth, the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, can make a sort of a fuzzy image of the corona that's fainter than the sky it's looking through, even from 14,000 feet of altitude, without any of the detail that we see at solar eclipses. And then there's so-called coronagraphs on a spacecraft, but they have to hide the whole inner and middle corona in order that it doesn't scatter around and blot out the outer corona. So, in other words, we're seeing something at the eclipse that we cannot see in any other way.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jay Pasikoff, astronomer at Williams College, and the person who has seen the most eclipses on Earth. What can studying the corona tell us about solar weather? You know, solar winds and sunspots and things that kind of reach the U.S.
When we looked at the eclipse in Gabon in Africa in 2013, there were two big eruptions coming out to the sides. They're called coronal mass ejections. So the bits of the corona that's gathered together by the magnetic field and drifting off at a million miles an hour. And then there was a prominence erupting. It's a more reddish stuff, a little closer in, that was also erupting. Well, that stuff was going off to the side because we could see it. But we're learning how fast things go, and we're learning how to study the precursors and see when things are might erupt. And sometimes those things are coming right at us. We see, for example, a coronal mass ejection as a halo around the sun, which means it's coming at us instead of just something we're seeing off to the side. So we want to be able to predict these things. We want to be able to save our spacecraft from being zapped by a huge blast of space weather. There's a history of a solar flare causing a surge in power lines and knocking out the electric grid in Quebec for many hours. There are all kinds of effects of the sun on the Earth that we now call space weather, and we're learning about it and learning better how to predict it.
I was looking at one of your textbooks, and it has a graph that shows the number of sunspots since 1750. There's 1750. And sunspots are a kind of solar phenomenon, like solar weather. And it's about as regular as a graph as anyone might wish, almost like a heartbeat. It's really quite regular. Some people have suggested that global warming can be blamed on solar activity, this solar activity cycle, rather than on human activity. Do we know enough about the solar activity cycle to be able to answer questions like that?
That's been carefully looked at, and the conclusion is that the variation, and we're talking now a long-term variation, is not enough to cause the changes in space weather that we're in terrestrial weather that we're now seeing. We can see that there is a change in the solar brightness of a tenth of a percent from solar maximum to solar minimum, and sometimes a dark sunspot can cause that that amount of stuff too. But that averages out over time. We have been making accurate measurements from space that get all the radiation from the sun, not just the part that passes through the Earth's atmosphere, since the late 1970s. So we've been through several cycles. And Greg Kopp, especially at the University of Colorado in Boulder, has carefully calibrated that. You'll have to look elsewhere for a cause of global warming. I'm pretty upset at the latest probable effect of the global warming, which is more forest fires, because there have been forest fires all around the western United States. So we hope they don't interfere with our observing of the eclipse in the clearest possible sky.
The corona is really, really hot. This is kind of like the solar atmosphere, as we've been talking about. And it's about 2 million degrees. The surface of the sun is only about 6,000 degrees only. You know, you could cook something pretty fast with 6,000 degrees. But why? Do we know why the corona is so hot?
Well, first of all, let me say that hot is a measure of temperature. And temperature, for a physicist, is a measure of how fast the individual particles are moving. So it is true that the corona is 2 million degrees in that the particles are moving that fast, but there are very few particles. So you wouldn't actually cook your turkey in the corona, even though it's very hot, because it's a very good vacuum. It's very sparsely populated. It's the difference between say a flame's temperature and a boiling tub. If you went into a boiling tub, there's so much water around you, you'd die from the immersion. Whereas just a plain high temperature you could take for a fraction of a second. Anyway, we're sure that somehow the magnetic field of the sun contributes to getting the energy from the everyday surface of the sun or from below it into the corona and making those particles go so fast. But as I like to say, a dozen people have solved the problem, but we have a dozen different solutions. There just hasn't been an agreement on just how the magnetic field makes that corona take up energy from below and get get up to a couple of million degrees Fahrenheit. There is consensus that it's a magnetic field, and we see a lot of changes in the configuration of the magnetic field. The magnetic field, when it's concentrated on the surface of the sun to thousands of times higher than it usually is, makes a darker region called a sunspot. And a sunspot really is often as bright as the full moon, but it's only that it's surrounded by brighter solar surface, brighter photosphere, that makes it look relatively dark. So those are regions of concentrated magnetic field, and we can see sometimes that magnetic field explosively reconnects in a different way, a different configuration between the north and south poles, and gives off a lot of energy at that point as a solar flare. Well, the magnetic field in the corona is strong enough to concentrate the shapes that we see into these coronal streamers or plumes at the poles, but it's a much weaker magnetic field than we see in the sunspots, and we actually haven't been able to measure the strength of the coronal magnetic field directly. We infer that from what we see. So I'm working with people at Predictive Science, Zoran Mikic and John Linker, a company in California that uses the full magneto-hydrodynamic solutions, in other words, the full physics equations solutions, looking at the magnetic field on the sun's surface, which is mapped every day, and calculating what the coronal shapes should be above it. And then we'll be photographing that at the eclipse itself, and we'll compare it with the predictions, and we hope we'll improve the basic physics behind the predictions that will help us understand all kinds of things for the future, including some aspects of making fusion energy on Earth, which uses in things people are trying out the magnetic field to hold very hot gas in place.
How did you first get hooked on solar eclipses?
Well, I was interested in astronomy as a high school student at the Bronx High School of Science. And when I came to Harvard as a freshman, there happened to be, first of all, the first year of a new project called Freshman Seminars to link the senior professors with the freshmen. And then there happened to be an eclipse of the sun that started over Boston, basically, and the peak was in Europe, but I didn't know that even. Professor Donald Menzel, the director of the observatory, was an eclipse veteran and had written major books of analysis and articles of analysis of eclipse results, and he was able to borrow a Northeast Airlines airplane and took our freshman seminar up aloft to see this eclipse. So I saw it out the window, and it was just wonderful. That led a friend and me to go to an eclipse when I just graduated from Harvard in 1963. We were able to drive up to Jonty, Quebec to see that eclipse. And then I worked off and on getting some eclipse results after that. I did my PhD thesis on other parts of the sun, though I'm sure that I was asked to participate in the solar observing because I had this eclipse interest. So it was really that eclipse that I saw as a freshman that started me doing solar astronomy, and that name has just been changed to heliophysics, and I've been doing it for quite a while now, and it's just great.
That's Jay Pasikoff, astronomer at Williams College and the chair of the International Astronomical Union's Working Group on Solar Eclipses. He's seen 65 solar eclipses in his life, and that's the largest number of any person on Earth. He plans to watch today's eclipse from Oregon. Jay Pasikoff, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you, and I hope everybody enjoys whatever eclipse they get today, but really concentrates on getting in the zone of totality the next time.
I'm Elsa Partin. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Elsa Partin, in for Heather Goldstone. Today is the day a total solar eclipse will pass over tens of millions of people in a 70-mile swath across the United States. It starts in Oregon around noon our time and travels across 14 states, finishing up its continental tour in South Carolina around 10 minutes before 3 o'clock this afternoon. Here in Massachusetts, we'll see a 63% eclipse around 2:45 this afternoon. My next guest has seen 8 total solar eclipses, and he's thought a lot about what eclipses have meant to us culturally, from ancient times to the present. Anthony Avini has appointments in two departments at Colgate University, physics and astronomy, and sociology and anthropology. His newest book is In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. Anthony Avini, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, Els. It's nice to be with you.
We have evidence that people have been amazed by total solar eclipses for thousands of years. For those of us who have never experienced a total eclipse, like me, it can be hard to understand what the big deal is. How would you describe it?
Well, it certainly is nature's the most awe-inspiring phenomenon, and I think whether you are religious or not, you will have a religious experience, I'll put that in quotation marks, when you see darkness happen in the middle of the day. An interruption in a regular diurnal pattern of light and dark, going through all the motions of a twilight, but a twilight that's different from any twilight you've ever seen, twilight that goes all the way around the horizon, sharp shadows that make the nose on your neighbor's face look grotesque. You know, you see the shadow of the nose up against the face, the colorations, and then, of course, when the totality occurs, the wonderful, marvelous colors of the corona that you can debate. Is it pearl? Is it brown? Is it reddish brown? Is it, what is it? Nobody can agree. But then the stars and the planets come out in the daytime. And it's something that if you've never seen it before, you simply have to see. And even if you have to wait until 2024, when you folks in New England will be close enough to see one not so far away, you have to do it. I know I heard you mention, Elsa, 63% as a partial eclipse, but I will tell you the difference between partiality and totality is like the difference between going to the Super Bowl the day before the game and on the day of the game. It's that awe-inspiring. Astronomers even have been known to have the hair on the back of their neck raised up. Even though we know what causes an eclipse, you still have that, what I would call sublime experience.
And you mentioned 2024. The closest place that we could go in that year would be southern Vermont?
Well, you'd have to go to the northwest corner of Vermont, up near Burlington, northern Vermont, to experience totality. But you'll be doing what everybody's been doing up to today, watching the map to see, you know, do we go toward Nashville or do we go toward Charleston, at least in the east? And then out west, of course, where are we going to head? We've got to go up different highways to get to where we want to get. And it would be a shame to get robbed by the gods of darkness who bring the clouds on instead of the, you know, what we want to see is that total darkness and the corona.
In your book, you write, the word eclipse is from eclipsis, from the Greek, implies fear. It means failure in the sense of something going wrong. Seeing an eclipse leaves you breathless, even if you know what's going on. Like the thrill of a roller coaster ride, you know you're safe, but the sense of alarm looms within you.
When you see the interruption of what normally happens, even though you know the science of it, it still gets to you. I mean, seeing the phenomenon. I remember a young woman, and I've seen eight of these, and I remember a young woman on one of my trips, a real science, math science student, and we'd gone through all the geometry of eclipses and everything, and she came up to me afterward with her glasses. Now she'd just taken her glasses off to protect her eyes during totality, and we were in the receding partial phases at the end of the eclipse, and she had tears streaming down her face, and she said to me, you know, you may have explained all of the scientific workings of the eclipse, but to me, the whole thing was a miracle. The whole thing was a miracle. And I think that's what happens when you see the interruption of events that normally happen. It's very, very unsettling. An earthquake is unsettling, and so is a tornado. Well, there we know they can cause disaster, and it's hard to predict them. But with the eclipse, even though we have safe knowledge that nothing's going to harm us, maybe it reminds us of the human past that we all share when nature intruded on us, and maybe with a message, maybe a message to us that we might begin to wonder about. Now, I'm not getting all religious on you here, but I am explaining here a human reaction that that is common, no matter what your training is. I think it's interesting, you know, common sense for those of us who understand science is, you know, it's kind of based on the conviction that the material world doesn't have any link with or any power over humans. The thought that somebody would actually believe in material objects affecting us, like rabbit's feet we carry for good luck or wood for knocking on, that in dealing with human affairs would bother our rationally cultivated minds. And that's why we're asking all these questions today, is, you know, why are we all so awestruck and at this sublime experience, as it was once called.
Now, so you're a cultural astronomer. That's one way.
People chaser. So I like to go after the eclipse chasers to see what their reaction is. And it's interesting, you know, with the anthropology of eclipses, even though I'm trained as a scientist, I began to become very interested in my early part of my career with cultural astronomy, that is, how different cultures understand and explain the cosmos. There's not a lot written on this, and that's why I wanted to collect material in the Shadow of the Moon book to talk about reactions, really not just on the part of people, but every living thing, from zooplankton in the sea to bees to chimps. And I have stories about all of these animals and how they behave, and then, of course, stories of people that I've been able to gather from history and from anthropological studies.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Elsa Partan, in for Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Anthony Avini, author of In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. Let's talk about Stonehenge. For cultural astronomers, it seems like there's a cautionary tale in here, and it has to do with an astronomer named Gerald Hawkins, who wrote a book in 1965 saying he had definitive proof that Stonehenge was built as a computer. What happened after that?
Well, it's interesting. At the time, of course, computers were just coming into vogue. I mean, the early IBM 650 and other computers were around, and I think it was interesting that Hawkins used the computer to determine that Stonehenge was indeed a computer. I think he was partially right in the sense that we do know that rising and setting positions of the sun and the moon at their extreme points on the horizon are indicated at Stonehenge, and it is possible, I mean, we can't prove this, but it is quite possible that particularly the lunar positions, the full moon, when it rises at its northern and southern extremes, could have been used to predict eclipses. It would not surprise me at all if that were the case. Now, over the years, archaeologists have debated the use of Stonehenge, and the theory is still out there. But we've got to be very careful not to make it into an analog computer of extraordinary precision. And that's, of course, what we often have a tendency to do. But yes, eclipses were around then. And they were certainly observed. We know, at least based on the historical record, the earliest indication that we have of humans actually predicting solar eclipses doesn't come until the Babylonian era, and actually even very late then, so all the way back to about 136 B.C., with the discovery of a clay cuneiform document called the Saros Canon, where we know for sure that the Babylonians were nailing these eclipses down, as were the Maya in the New World. But we in the West, Babylonians are tradition, don't tend to pay much attention to the Maya, who are from another cultural tradition. But they were doing the same kind of thing, trying to tune in to the solar-lunar beat, as I call it, that beat or rhythm for predicting eclipses.
Hmm. So Stonehenge could have been kind of an eclipse calculator or computer, but you actually write that it seems like it was a multi-use architecture.
Yeah, I think it was, and it may have much more to do with worshiping the moon and the sun. And again, we go back to this statement about our common sense, you know, saying that, well, how could the moon and the sun affect what goes on the Earth? Well, of course, the moon causes the tides, and the sun is certainly responsible for the seasons. So who's to say that the tides and the affairs of men and women aren't influenced by these objects? Well, that's what we call astrology. But we need to understand that most cultures around the world did believe in an interconnected universe, and they were a part of it. The universe was teeming with life, and we were all a part of it. The Maya believed they were the custodians of the world, and they had to make sure that their actions, what they did here on Earth, mirrored what went on in heaven and what the gods would foresee as an ideal universe. So there is that human cosmic connection in most of these cultures, I find.
I'm Elsa Partan, in for Heather Goldstone. It's Living Lab Radio, and I'm talking with Anthony Avini about the cultural astronomy of eclipses. And there's a happy accident of today's solar eclipse. You know, in the book, that it will pass over Alliance, Nebraska, which is home of Carhenge, you know, the old Cadillacs and Buicks stuck in the ground. And they are actually having quite a celebration today.
They're having a good time out there today and at that Stonehenge replica. And as people are everywhere who are seeing the event together, it's really fascinating that this becomes a group activity. All the eclipse chasers are sharing in this witnessing this sublime event that is going to make their hair stand on the back of their neck. And, of course, then as soon as it's over, they'll all be talking about how far the corona stretched and what the color of the corona was, and then immediately beginning to plan their next venture. And that's going to happen around here in 2024. You know, we've waited 99 years for this transcontinental eclipse. And there's another one, 2024, that is going to travel from West Texas all the way up to our area in northern New England, far northern New England, and you'll want to make sure you're there.
Let's talk about the Antikythera mechanism.
Antikythera is the name of an island off the coast of Turkey, Asia Minor, as it was called. Remarkable device, dates from maybe the first century B.C., and it is a series of gears, which, of course, all rusted out, but they've been studied and photographed in various wavelengths. But apparently this was a very, very precise eclipse predictor. It also predicted the leap year and the occurrence of the occurrence of the movement of Venus and other phenomena. And we have to wonder, I mean, this certainly couldn't have been one of a kind. The Greeks put it in machine form. The Babylonians did it all by arithmetic before, and they were able to tune into that rhythm. It's what I call the 6-5 beat, and you find it on the Antikythera mechanism as well as in that Saros canon dated to 136 B.C. You know, if you follow eclipses, it's not difficult to predict that, you know, if you today's eclipse, August 21st, 2017, will definitely not be followed by an eclipse next month, nor the eclipse, nor the month after that. You have to wait 6 months, but then sometimes 5 months. In fact, it's a string of sixes and fives, like a half a dozen sixes and a five, or seven sixes and a five, that couple together to give that 6-5 rhythm. And if you have records that go back far enough, now we don't know what they had in Stonehenge, and we don't know even what they had in ancient China, because we don't have the records, but we do have the records in Babylon, that go back at least 300 or 400 years before 136 B.C., which tell us for sure that the Babylonians had got this 6-5 rhythm down. It's interesting that the Maya, on the other side of the world, tapped in to the same 6-5 pattern, but they had a different rhythm, a different combination of sixes and fives. But they were humming the same tune in the end, even though the beats were a little bit different.
And the book is the In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. I'm talking with Anthony Avini. This is Living Lab Radio, and I'm Elsa Partan. Your specialty has been in the historical astronomy of pre-Columbian Mesoamerican cultures. What else should we know about the Aztecs as well?
Well, the Aztecs, of course, had a great sunstone that some of my colleagues think might have been an eclipse stone. I'm not sure I agree. We know that they were sun worshippers and that they paid very close attention to the sun. They even write in their pictorial documents that the sun inspires them to expand their empire, you know, any excuse for expansionism. The Maya were quite different, and so were the people in the Andes, but there are these eclipse stories that we call myths that I think we tend to pass off as superstition. You know, we might say, well, the Aztecs were superstitious for worshipping the sun. And I think we have to look, and I, as a cultural astronomer, want to look deeper into the historical record and the anthropological record regarding the meaning of eclipses. I'll just give you one example to illustrate. You know, there are people, the ancestors of the descendants of the Inca, who say that they had to beat their dogs to make them howl, and they had to bang their drums during a total eclipse. Now, we look at that, and you look in most texts, and they'll tell you, well, they had to chase away the demons. But when the anthropologist bothers to ask these people why they're doing that, they give a very different kind of answer that doesn't sound so superstitious. The answer is, they say, that we are trying to get the sun's attention, trying to get the sun's attention, because the moon, who rules the night, is telling lies about us. They're telling lies about things that we do at night. So we're trying to get the sun's attention. Can't you see the earlobe of the sun, just about to be eclipsed sun? Well, that's his ear, and the moon is whispering into it, telling about these lies. So the reason why we're making noise and making our dogs bark and banging our drums is to get the sun's attention, to tell him not to listen to the moon, who is making up these horrible lies. And
wow.
So then the eclipse becomes an occasion to have a discussion or a discourse about how bad it is to lie. So it's all really more about lying rather than some silly superstition where we're making noise to chase away demons. So that's one example from my book of these so-called myths that we tend to disregard, but they do tell us a lot about people. And my interest is, as I say, more in the people who chase eclipses and watch eclipses than the eclipse itself.
And we also have to look with some suspicion at the how the Spanish portray the Aztecs as bloodthirsty people who are constantly sacrificing other humans. They had a reason to portray the Aztecs as backward, didn't they?
Well, they did. They were trying to conquer them. And I think it's an interesting story in that connection, coming from the other side of Mexico with the Maya, where we have contemporary people who still adhere to many of the old customs. A colleague of mine, Gary Gosen, wrote an interesting book called The Chamula and the World of the Sun. The Chamula are people who live in the village of Chamula, who are Maya, contemporary Maya people. And he was interviewing this Maya man about the sun and what you believe in the sun and what you believe in eclipses. And suddenly the Maya man turned to him and said, "Now, do you Americans, do you bite each other? Do you bite each other?" And the anthropologist said, "Bite each other? Of course not. We don't. Why do you people bite each other?" And the Maya man said, no, but our ancestors used to. And what he was referring to was the myth of cannibalism, which was propagated by the Spaniards, who made up this story about these people being cannibals, which was partly a justification for conquering the Aztecs and the Maya. The anthropologist continued the interview and discovered that this Maya man believed, like most Maya people, that people who are far from far away in distance are also from far away in the past. So you Americans come from a faraway place. You must know about living in the past. And that's why the man was inquiring into the past. I think that's interesting because you could say this Maya man being interviewed was connecting space with time, as though not by relativity or an expanding universe, but the idea that space and time are related. When the discussion concluded, the anthropologist realized that this was really important for the Maya man to know because the Maya people believe that they are the ones who are the custodians of the universe. They are the people who keep things in balance. And so we have to have a discussion in our society, the man said, so that we know how we can maintain balance in the universe. So far from being chasing away the demons because they're biting the sun, you know, that's only the surface of the myth. The detail of it is that the eclipse is an occasion to talk about restoring balance in the universe. And I think that's coming to everybody today who's witnessing this phenomenon. The universe looks as if it's out of balance. It's doing something that's kind of strange and weird. And even though we know scientifically what causes it, it's a reminder that nature can behave in strange ways.
That's Anthony Avini, author of In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. He has appointments in two departments at Colgate University, physics and astronomy, and sociology and anthropology. Anthony Avini, thanks for talking with me.
Great to talk to you, Elsa, and happy viewing.
That's our show for today. Heather Goldstone will be back next week. I'm Elsa Partan. Thanks for listening.